This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Harry Klein never thought he'd go to college. He spent years in and out of prisons, but he graduated last month and says finally getting an education made all the difference.
It's the floodgates to open up everything. I don't care what happened to you, you know, how your past went. Getting the education brings like so many possibilities.
The importance of education for inmates and former prisoners and how far higher education has yet to go on that front. Plus, Ryan Denham reports on the workers at the Rivian Auto Plant. It might be electric, it might be high tech, it's still manufacturing. And Colleen Reynolds reports on Habitat Heroes. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The electric automaker Rivian likes to talk about its new approach to battery-powered vehicles, autonomous driving, and internet-powered dashboard. But inside its normal manufacturing plant, there are still reminders that auto manufacturing is still auto manufacturing, even if gasoline has been replaced by electricity. GLT's Ryan Denham talks to a former Mitsubishi worker who, like the plant itself, now has a second chance to make cars.
3 years ago, Wade Jensen punched the clock for the last time at Mitsubishi's manufacturing plant in Norman.
I remember taking pictures when I left, the day that I left, sitting in my car of the gate that I walked in every day for years and making the social media comments last day on to new adventures, thinking you would never be back here again.
But here he is, once again. He's now engineering manager for Rivian's first assembly line, getting the electric automaker ready for production to begin next year. Of the 60 or so Rivian employees in Normal now, about half are former Mitsubishi workers like Jensen. He says it was surreal to walk back into the plant.
When you've done it for 28 years, it's your passion. I mean, it's what's in you. It's what's in your heart. It's your desire. And to have the opportunity to see this plant producing cars and putting them out the back door again, I was all in.
Jensen was eager to give me a tour of the Rivian plant last week. It's massive, around the size of 24 Walmarts. It looks even bigger now that it's so empty. Some sections are cordoned off by Rivian prep work. We cruise past lots of old Mitsubishi equipment that Rivian is deciding whether to sell, use, or scrap. It's a big difference from the days when Mitsubishi was cranking out 200,000 vehicles a year in the 90s and early 2000s.
We had a 52-second cycle time, so that means every 52 seconds, one car was moving from station to station. So our goal was to at least get one car a minute off the end of the line.
Rivian is planning to make 50,000 electric pickups and SUVs here, about a quarter of Mitsubishi's peak production. Jensen says that lower volume means Rivian won't be as heavily automated as Mitsubishi was. That begins later this year with what Rivian calls validation builds. They'll build around 70 vehicles on roll-around carts, static builds, they call them, instead of running them up and down the assembly line. Jensen says those 70 vehicles will then be divvied up for crash testing, manufacturing training, and other company needs.
This area we're coming up on to now.
My tour with Wade Jensen takes us to a well-lit, newly painted, but still very much empty section of the plant, a reminder that automakers' plans don't always come to fruition.
Back in Mitsubishi's time, in the early 2000s, early to mid-2000s, this was an expansion that Mitsubishi put on for their SUV. I don't know if you remember the Endeavor, the bigger SUV.
Oh, yeah.
Mitsubishi Endeavor. Huh? This is where production for that vehicle was going to be done. But obviously, everybody knows what happened to the economy about that time, and everything started going south. Mm-hmm. And so this was never utilized for any of that. This is where it lends itself perfectly to Rivian's plan. This will become our first battery factory.
Those batteries will be the heart and soul of the new Rivian vehicles. Rivian says the biggest ones will give 400 miles of driving range on a single charge. They'll sit on a skateboard base that'll be shared across Rivian's vehicles and maybe even sold to other companies that'll make their own electric vehicles with Rivian's technology. Rivian's battery manufacturing process is still being developed in Irvine, California, and then will be recreated here in Illinois.
So everything out in Irvine right now is their design, technical process development. working out all the bugs, fine-tuning it, and then from there, they'll decide on what equipment and what layout they need to move all that to the facility here.
For Jensen, this will be the second time he's been on the ground floor for a young automaker. He was hired in 1988 as a second-shift supervisor at the Chrysler-Mitsubishi joint venture, known as Diamond Stars, when it first launched. He rose through the ranks, spending time in Japan to help launch cars. He became maintenance and engineering manager. But in 2015, he lost his job just like 1,200 of his co-workers. Production was moved back to Japan.
It was kind of a shock to everybody. I'm sitting at home and start getting all these text messages and phone calls about, hey, are you seeing the news and what's going on? Of course, you kind of push it aside. But then the next day you come in and they make the official announcement in July that November of 15 would be the end of our production here.
In the last 3 years, the 56-year-old father of three bounced from job to job doing engineering work, most recently for a Caterpillar contract company in Pontiac, his hometown. 2 years ago, Rivian bought the plant from a liquidator for $16 million, a bargain price. It hired back a dozen or so maintenance guys, and Jensen's name kept coming up. Soon, he was hired too.
You know, to see normally aspirated cars and try to change my vision to electric cars 100% is not only a passion, but intriguing to me at the same time.
For now, Jensen says the hardest part is all the new lingo and acronyms. Mitsubishi's final assembly line, snaking north to south through the plant, is now called Rivian's general assembly line. Structure studies are now validation builds. Aside from those differences, Jensen sees a lot of similarities.
Anybody that you talk to that's in the automotive business, they all do the same things. They all know that there's prototype builds to prove out parts. There's tooling builds to prove out tooling. There's all these steps that you follow, and it's pretty much the same from company to company.
Rivian's hiring in Normal will ramp up throughout this year and next. It now has 600 employees company-wide, with most in Michigan, California, and the United Kingdom. To get its millions in local and state tax breaks, Rivian has promised to hire 1,000 full-time workers here in the next 5 years. That would make it one of McLean County's largest employers again. The first vehicles are scheduled to come off the assembly line in 2020. Jensen says he's excited to be back.
It's intriguing, and at the same time, some days it's a little daunting. But, you know, when you get my age, it sounds strange, but I'm not that far from retirement. But if I can keep doing this and stay this excited about it, I don't know when I'll retire.
From inside the Rivian plants, I'm Ryan Denham.
You can follow all of GLT's Rivian coverage at WGLT.org/Rivian.
Support for GLT comes from Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC. Over 30 years of experience, reputable financial management with an independent perspective. Drake Zimmerman has been a proud sponsor of GLT since 1983. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a report on the effect of education on the lives of former inmates. That's from IPR in just a few minutes on 89.1 and WGLT.org. McLean County Habitat for Humanity is launching a first-ever Heroes of Habitat series to honor local heroes while raising money in their name to build affordable housing for low-income residents. The inaugural Hero House, scheduled to be built later this year, will honor local Army Ranger Sergeant Josh Rogers, who was killed in action in Afghanistan in April of 2017. GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds sat down with Rogers' mother, Vonda, and Habitat construction manager Bill Waller to get the backstory about how the idea emerged from a random encounter.
Bill Waller, construction manager for McLean County Habitat for Humanity. You've been around for a couple of decades, and in that time you've really contributed to overseeing a lot of construction that adds affordable housing right here to our community. And it was on just one of those job sites that you had an epiphany that has led to an announcement about a new initiative.
Well, I was over on the corner of Chestnut and Henshaw, and I came across the Military Affinity Group working on a veteran's house. It's the first veteran's house we've done here in McLean County in quite some time. And I met Vonda Rogers, who is the mother of Josh Rogers, who was killed in action in Afghanistan in 2017. I hadn't had the opportunity to meet her till that time. time. I had seen her in the community, but I had never talked to her. So we talked briefly, and I shared my regrets and couldn't stand there long because I was becoming weepy-eyed. And so I went to my truck and cried my eyes out like a baby. And it came to me then that we need to do something as a community for this family to show our respect and support. And I came up with Heroes of Habitat, which is being released today.
Vonda, I know that the community has really reached out and embraced you and tried to support you and your family in honoring and remembering Josh in a variety of ways. He really made the ultimate sacrifice. Just to remind some people in the community, because it's been a while since he's been in the news, but explain what happened to your son.
Wednesday, April 26th was one of those days that does not stand out in my mind for any reason other than after we went to bed that night, there was a knock on the door, and my husband grabbed me out of bed and said, "There's two military people at the door." And when you're a military mom, the idea of two military people coming to your door is, well, it's the worst idea. And so slowly crept down the stairs, and indeed, Kevin had let them in. There was a chaplain and a soldier standing inside the front door, and I just went up to her and said, you know, just tell me. And she said, perhaps we should go sit down, and I said, you know, just tell me. And all I really heard was, your son, Sergeant Joshua Patrick Rogers, had been killed in action. I remember screaming, falling to the floor. I didn't picture the big soldier, you know, the big strong man he had become. I just pictured my baby being ripped out of my arms, and it was an indescribable moment. You know, it's not supposed to happen that way, and for some people, unfortunately, it does. And so, 24 hours later, we were in Dover, and Josh was coming home from Germany, and it was then that I learned more of the story, because his best friend Tyler brought him home from Afghanistan. And Tyler told me that there had been, you know, quite a conflict that happened that night. Josh's date of death is April 27th, 2017, because there's a time difference between the United States and Afghanistan. And that night, they had taken three helicopters of Rangers and some Afghan army, and they had went into an ISIS stronghold located in the Nangarhar region of Afghanistan, which is right there along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. That's where we had dropped the mother of all bombs, that big, huge bomb. We dropped that early last year, and then in April, they went in to capture the leader of ISIS. And so he told me that there had been an intense firefight. One of Josh's friends later explained it to me as, if you were standing on the 50-yard line at the Super Bowl and looked around and saw the flashlights or the cameras or lighters going off, that's what it looked like. As they were being attacked from the hills all around them. Josh and another young man, Sergeant Cameron Thomas, were both fatally wounded. Tyler and the other Rangers that were out there are all sure to tell me that in typical Josh style, after they had landed and Josh was in charge of a 20-foot ladder in addition to his team, that as they were going towards their point, he was shot in the leg, and I'm told that he calmly passed the ladder off to another guy, tied a tourniquet on his leg, took the ladder back, and said, "Let's go." And that is absolutely Josh's style. So we grieve, of course, because our son died, but we celebrate because we know that Josh died doing exactly what he always wanted to do. And if he had to die, that would have been exactly the way he wanted to go. So the community at that point was amazing, overwhelmingly amazing. Our neighbors pitched in. There were flags up and down our street. There was food. There was paper products. A group of people from State Farm, where we work, put bags together, and the neighbors contributed. All the Rangers that came to town had a bag that had all the essentials in it that they would need. And the community just poured love over us. I know a lot of people stood alongside the road, and that's how I met Bill, because he told me he was standing there. And I love to meet people who say that, because I can't really remember it. So if you were there, you need to tell me, because I don't remember seeing you. I've prayed for a long time for a way to give back to the community, and I think Bill helped me found the way.
So Bill Waller, you were inspired after meeting Vonda, and this fortuitous meeting stuck with you and ultimately resulted in an initiative that you're talking about today. Tell us.
Yeah, it was something else. I was inspired by meeting her in the first place, and I started talking to her. The first thing I did was get in my truck and ask for permission, which I don't do very often, very well either, but I asked permission, you know, to go after this. So then I let it settle with me for a day. Then I contacted Vonda after they had talked to me, and they did some research, and there's really nothing like this that's happened nationally through Habitat International. Says, like, no, this is the first time this has happened, so I'm really looking forward to breaking new ground with this thing.
Well, let's be clear about exactly what you are going to do, and starting with remembering Josh Rogers in a special way.
We are we're going to name this house after him. We're going to put a stone in the front yard, and it's going to honor Josh and his sacrifice to the country. We're going to raise money in the community, make it so that the community has a chance to thank the family the way we want to. So many people have echoed that sentiment. We wish there was something we could do to say thank you, and this is going to be the way to do that. It's going to be one way in which to do it. So we've started Heroes for Habitat. This is the first in a series. We hope to continue this long past the time that I leave Habitat. I believe that it will. There's a lot of heroes in this community, and we're going to have a chance to honor those people, much in the way Red Cross does, or there's several other opportunities in the community to you know, pick people out and say, hey, you know, thank you. So that's what we're doing.
I'm Colleen Reynolds. You're listening to Sound Ideas, and we're talking with Habitat for Humanity construction manager Bill Waller and Vonda Rogers, mother of Josh Rogers, a U.S. Army Ranger who lost his life in service to our country in Afghanistan. And we're learning that the first Habitat Heroes House will be in Josh Rogers' honor. Now, Vonda, there have been other honors that are being bestowed on Josh posthumously, including having the post office in Uptown Normal being named for him. How is this a little different or special to you?
I was taught that there's a belief among soldiers that you die twice. The first time is when your spirit leaves your body, and the second time is when your name stops being said. And so it's so important for every Gold Star parent, every parent of a soldier or sailor, someone in the military who's killed in action, that there are ways established that will ensure that their loved one's name is not forgotten. This one's different, however, because the Red Cross honor, the memorial we have at the high school, the post office, those are awesome. They're awesome places that and things that you can see and think about, and you think of Josh. But this is real. As I said, I prayed for a way to give back to the community. And when Bill talked to us about this, my husband Kevin and I, it seemed to be the perfect way. I prayed for a big way to give back to the community, and I'm pretty sure a house is about as big as it gets. So this is not a house for a hero. This is a house built in honor of a hero. And so I look forward to working with people, hammering in those nails, putting up some paint. We'll build that house. We'll build it in Josh's memory with Josh's name on the outside, and I think it's an absolutely phenomenal way. The second way it's different, and one of the things that I think most excited me, is Habitat for Humanity donates 10% of all the money that they give to Habitat International, so they tithe 10%. And so my request was, let's do that for the Hero Houses too. So for every house we raise the money to build here, we will actually also be building 3 houses in Haiti. If we raise enough money to build this year's Hero House and next year's Hero's House, we'll build 6 houses in Haiti. So that is awesome. Josh was all about helping those that could not help themselves. He was just an absolutely fierce friend, and he would fight for anyone that really just couldn't fight for themselves. And I think this is a way we can fight for the people in Haiti.
Bill Waller, what does it take to start hammering nails for a Habitat house, how much money do you need to raise before you can begin on the first hero's house?
The covenants on the Habitat house this year are $40,000. The actual cost of the house is about $85,000, and we work strictly with donations. We don't take any government funding. This isn't a government project. This is our neighbors stepping up and saying, "Here, we're here to help," and that's what we do. It's always been like that, Habitat, and I'm very proud to be associated with that. It's a beautiful thing that you see the community step up and say, "Hey, we're here." Additionally, the family that is going to receive this house has been vetted. They are people in need. They have several needs, and they're also required sweat equity. So, you know, we're going to make sure that they respect the house as well. We're not giving anything away. Give you a hand up, not a handout.
You have a lot already set aside for this house in particular?
We're going through lot selection right now. I suspect this time next week we'll be able to announce where this house will be. Working our way through family selection and getting ready to go.
I can't help but notice that you get choked up for every time you try to talk about this, and you were not a veteran yourself. Why does this get you and hit you so deeply, Bill?
Well, there's a lot of different things about it, honestly. I think Vonda said it best, that she really respects the fact that I mourn her son. And I'm not really sure why that is. It's just the way I feel about it. It sets in my heart. It's from the day that I saw the hearse roll by, it sat in my heart since then. So it's something I'm truly thankful that I get to do. Not everybody has this opportunity, this honor, so I'm very happy to get to do that.
And Vonda, I guess a message to all of the people who've reached out to you and said, "What can I do?" You now have a place to sort of direct their energies. Do you have any predictions for how successful this fundraising could be? Possibly be?
Well, I think we can build at least this year's and next year's Hero House and really set this program up for success. If we can get three houses that could be fully paid for, so that then we're fundraising for the future, I think that's the best. After Josh died, we did set up a scholarship. We have a Sergeant Josh Rogers scholarship, and we do use that. We have a scholarship at Normal Community High School for a football player, and we use it throughout the community for youth sports. This is a way people can give sweat equity. Those who can't give financially, those who can only give financially have that opportunity, but we will all stand together at the end, which I'm hoping is near Veterans Day, but we haven't got that quite figured out. But we'll all stand together, and we'll know that with Josh's influence, we did this. So I'm kind of counting on three houses at least. People can give on the website. We're also going to mark your calendars for the last weekend of April. We're going to have a fundraising event, so hopefully we can come back and talk about that once we have a few more details. And then I'm sure we'll have a few things other than that going forward. Oh, and if anybody has any ideas on fundraising, give us a call.
There'll be a Facebook page opening up, and then HabitatMcLean.org will have information directly, and we can move on from there. But yeah, it's going to be a huge opportunity for the community to come out and be a part of this. I mean, I don't want to be the only guy in the block going, "Hey, I was there doing that." So come on out and give us a hand.
Bill Waller and Vonda Rogers for Habitat for Humanity, speaking with GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds. The website for details on how you can help is HabitatMcLean.org.
Today's morning routine was just like yesterday's. Same toothpaste, same breakfast. But what was happening in the world outside your door was anything but ordinary. Progress, unrest, lives changed forever. Every weekday starts out the same until you listen. Turn on Morning Edition and the world will open up before your ears in a way that opens your eyes. Start every day fully awake with Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm GLT Morning Edition host John Norton. Join me weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Connect Transit. Get connected with Connect Transit 7 days a week. Riders can track buses in real time with the Connect Transit app for Android or iPhone. Information at connect-transit.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Up next on Bloomington Normal's Public Media, the plight of Central Illinois soybean farmers amid the China trade war. Like many people coming out of prison, Perry Klein never thought he'd go to college. Klein beat the odds. He graduated last month. As Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines explains, his story shows how important access to higher education is after prison and how much more colleges need to do to support formerly incarcerated students.
Klein grew up in Chicago. As a teenager, he was wrongly accused of a robbery, and he spent months in juvenile detention for a crime he says he didn't commit. And after he was released, he says his high school failed him.
I really didn't feel like I had a lot of support, you know, from the school, you know, because of that traumatic experience. Nobody came to me and gave me any counseling. I didn't go to a school like that.
Without the proper support he needed, Klein dropped out. He started hanging out with gangs and committing crimes. He spent time in Illinois prisons, and he got addicted to heroin. Then, in 2013, something happened that made Klein realize he needed to change. A friend overdosed on heroin in front of him. Instead of going to get help, Klein left to get more drugs. His friend later died.
You know, I could have saved him, you know, but I was thinking about getting that next one. I remember getting down on my knees. And I remember praying to God and asking me to get me out of his madness. And he did.
Klein got out of Chicago. An old girlfriend bought him a bus ticket to Champaign. When he arrived, he was homeless and in withdrawal. It was a pivotal moment for Klein. Then came another one. He started going to Narcotics Anonymous religiously. He told one of his friends from NA that he wanted to go to college.
One day, I was helping him move. And after we got through moving, he drove me right up to Parkland College. And he said, get out. He said, go register for school. And I did it.
When he enrolled in the college, he placed into a lot of remedial classes and he struggled.
Math was like my worst subject ever. So I had like started like real low in math. It's like straight humiliation. But I stuck it out, was there every day, you know, passing the test and going to the next level.
Sticking it out is unusual for formerly incarcerated students. That's according to one of Klein's advisors at Parkland College, Larry Taylor. He says Klein had a lot of factors working against him.
Black males in general are most at risk of not graduating and earning a degree. You couple that with being formerly incarcerated. So most of those students that I've worked with that were incarcerated, I can't think of maybe one or two that actually completed their academic goals.
But Klein got something he needed from the faculty and staff at Parkland, and that's support. He asked for help, and he received it. He spent hours outside of class working one-on-one with professors. And with Taylor's help, he got into the University of Illinois. Then he graduated.
Perry Klein.
That's Klein walking across the stage at his graduation from the U of I last month. Lots of people came to see him graduate, including his math professor from Parkland, Aaron Wilding Martin.
It was an emotional day. I was so proud of all the work that he's done. And there's an English professor here who also likes to keep track of how he's doing and keep in touch. And I took a picture of him going across the stage and texted to her, I'm not crying, you're crying.
Joni Schwartz says those kinds of emotional bonds between professors and formerly incarcerated students aren't unusual. They're actually necessary for students like Klein to succeed.
Someone who is there for them, accepts them unconditionally, and provides emotional, spiritual, academic support to them, that is key to their success.
Schwartz co-edited the book Race, Education, and Reintegrating Formerly Incarcerated Citizens. She says colleges need to proactively seek out formerly incarcerated people to offer that support. She suggests even going into the prisons to plant the seed that education is an option. Klein says getting his GED in prison planted that seed. And getting a college degree made all the difference in his life.
It's the floodgates to open up everything. I don't care what happened to you, you know, how your past went. Getting an education brings up so many possibilities.
Klein says he found his purpose in life, and that's helping others. He plans to pursue a master's degree in social work next. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
This story was produced with support from the Education Writers Association Reporting Fellowship Program. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, it's Oscar nomination season. GLT's Laura Kennedy visits with the GLT culture maven, Sherry Zeck. The new year begins with even more uncertainty for central Illinois farmers whose bottom lines are being held hostage by the U.S. trade war with China. U.S. negotiators just wrapped up trade talks with Chinese officials in Beijing. No deal reached, and the schedule for further talks uncertain. GLT's Ryan Denham visited a central Illinois farmer to learn how he's been impacted by the standoff.
All around Doug Schroeder's farm in Bellflower, in southeastern McLean County, there are remnants of a more profitable time. A 10,000-square-foot shed with heated floors they put up in 2011 when they were making money. $2 million in machinery, a faster system for moving grain between trucks and storage.
It's this great big hole in the side of the bin, and you pull a truck under it. I mean, it'll load a truck in no time at all. Quiet, takes no energy.
But this year, Schroeder won't be replacing any of that machinery. The ongoing trade dispute with China has hit soybean farmers like Schroeder hard. Prices dropped as China almost entirely stopped buying soybeans last year. And Schroeder says it's a double whammy because trade issues have also driven up the price of steel. That's the material used to make things like tractors.
And so not only are we getting less for our product that we're selling, but we have to pay more for the inputs we need to buy to make and produce corn and soybeans. So we kind of get kicked twice in this whole thing. You know, if you're not making the money, it's really hard to spend the money.
China used to be the biggest buyer of American soybeans. About a quarter of all Illinois beans typically go to China. But now, in retaliation for similar U.S. tariffs on Chinese imports, China imposed a 25% tariff on imports of U.S. soybeans, resulting in a dramatic drop in shipments.
The day the Chinese announced that tariff, the price of our soybeans dropped about 20%.
The average price for a bushel of soybeans has been around $11 for the last decade or so. Supply and demand is key here. China cuts into demand, and then last fall at harvest time, American farmers produced a record 4.6 billion bushels of beans. Supply up, demand down.
And then during harvest, I mean, we were selling beans here, or had the opportunity to sell beans for less than $8. I mean, there was a 7 in front of them, and that's historically a very, very low number.
That's changed the normal post-harvest routine for many farmers. Some waited to sell their beans, hoping for prices to tick up a bit. Grain elevators filled up. Some expanded their storage capacity. Here's Mike Levin, Director of Public Policy and Regulatory Affairs for the Illinois Soybean Association, based in Bloomington.
A negative effect, of course, on these tariffs and on our soybean producers has really become a reality as we step into, you know, the new year. We're now worried, of course, about the future. And many of my farmers are worried about their businesses and if they're going to continue on.
Doug Schroeder is a relatively large farmer, working over 4,000 acres in McLean, Piatt, and Champaign counties with his son and son-in-law. Tough trade disputes are actually the reason he grows corn and beans in the first place. Schroeder's father was a cattle farmer until the mid-70s, when growing Russian imports drove up the price of corn and farmland. So he switched to corn and beans. Then Russia invaded Afghanistan, and the Carter administration enacted a grain embargo against Russia.
The price of grain then crashed, and the price of land then followed. And the next thing you know, Willie Nelson came to the University of Illinois, and they had Farm Aid. I mean, that was a really, really a hard time, and that's when I was kind of cutting my teeth out here.
Schroeder says he agrees that the U.S.-China trade relationship needed to be rebalanced. A lot of farmers do, but not like what the Trump administration has done.
But using food as a way to strike back at a country has never worked over time. The consumers in both countries end up paying the price.
To soften the blow for farmers, the Trump administration has earmarked $9.5 billion in direct payments to growers of soybeans, corn, wheat, and other commodities most affected by tariffs.
The market facilitation program will help, but it won't make us whole.
The first round of payments went out in September. Schroeder's farm applied for payments at the end of 2018, expecting the money sometime in 2019. Emphasis on the sometime.
It's funny how stuff works out, but you know, the government shut down. You know, are our payments going to come or are they not going to come? We've been led to believe that they will come, but yet they haven't hit the mailbox yet. So time will tell. But what we really want is not aid. What we really want is just fair trade.
The deadline to sign up for the second round of payments was January 15th, but that's been extended indefinitely because with the shutdown, farmers haven't been able to apply with the USDA. And GLT was unable to find out how much has already been distributed to Central Illinois farmers because of the shutdown. The USDA press office is closed. Here's Mike Levin with the Illinois Soybean Association.
So we, of course, welcome these payments, but we'll say that it is a short-term fix.
Now, attention turns to the 2019 planting season. Farmers like Doug Schroeder say they're not going to be making any big capital purchases. That trickles down across the economy. As a result, farm columnist Alan Giebert from Delavan says expect even more consolidation in farm equipment dealers.
Competition is going to be incredibly tough in the coming year for machinery dealers, seed dealers, fertilizer dealers, you name it.
The Trump administration reached a 90-day trade truce with China last month, buying time for talks that continued this week in Beijing. That included a Chinese pledge to buy 1 to 2 million metric tons of soybeans. But Giebert says that purchase and the truce don't mean a whole lot just yet.
The 1 million metric ton is truly a drop in the export ocean. It's not very much. It's 1/30. So while every bit is good, I mean, I'd rather have one scoop of ice cream than not having any, but 30 sounds like a whole lot better. I mean, especially if that's where you were a year ago.
For Giebert, this whole trade dispute with China reveals a bigger issue with American farm policy, a policy supported by trade groups like the Farm Bureau and the Soybean Association. Giebert says our farm policy is focused on commodity production, exports, profits, efficiency, not food or rural development. That farm policy, he says, when paired with the Trump administration's tariff approach on trade, makes for a losing combination.
You can do whatever you want, but if you're doing the wrong thing as relative to the farm policy we have, and we are right now, then you have a circular firing squad. You really don't have a policy that's going to work now or in the future.
Giebert says one thing that's missing from U.S. farm policy, including the new farm bill, is an emphasis on rural America, which has been hollowed out in recent decades. That, he says, happens as ag giants like Monsanto and Deere continue to make money, even during this trade dispute. That's because the U.S. government is sending farmers money.
If you're going to give these guys cocaine, they're going to get addicted.
Doug Schroeder is on the Illinois Soybean Association's board of directors, too. He's headed to China on Saturday for a trade trip to meet with importers.
These are very, very smart people in China, very, very smart people in Washington. Let's get together. Let's get this thing worked out. The world's becoming a more interwoven place all the time. There's got to be a win-win situation here somehow. So we're hopeful that both these governments will get together, sit down, and move ahead in a positive direction.
That's McLean County farmer Doug Schroeder talking with GLT's Ryan Denham. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. One of Hollywood's favorite words seems to be remake. That's right up there with money. But is it box office that's driving the remake trend, or does the lack of originality have less to do with filmmakers and more to do with audience desires? As the Oscars announce their nominations today, we head into the heart of the movie season awards, and GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
If so many films at the multiplex seem like something you've already seen before, it's because you have seen it before. Hollywood is busy churning out remakes. Aladdin, Logan's Run, Mary Poppins, Scarface, Clueless. If it's been done, it will likely be done again. Sherry Zeck is interim dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University and is GLT's culture maven. She says, sure, there's a distressing lack of imagination in Hollywood that helps to drive this lust for remakes. But even more so, producers know that remakes have a built-in audience.
In a way, they're kind of a variation on the series film. You can't make a 109th Star Wars, but you could remake a Star Trek or reboot a Star Trek.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because a remake and a reboot are different things. A remake, I think,
sort of stays true to its source material and just retells the tale. A reboot takes it in a different direction, oftentimes something that might be darker or more gritty, like with the case of Spider-Man.
Well, I'm not sure I'd 100% agree with you on that. I think reboot really means it's going to be a series, and remake means a one-off. So I would beg to differ on that,
okay.
Although I do think your observation is apt that often reboots of these popular series are darker and modernized in some way, but they wouldn't really be reboot if they didn't also still have the heart of what the original was in a way. So if you had a Star Trek reboot and you didn't have a friendship between Spock and Captain Kirk,
mm.
or you didn't have Kirk be sort of a renegade adventurer, or you didn't have phasers and the computer voice, and then it really wouldn't be a reboot.
Reboot is something that is far more recent for us, but remakes have been with us for a long, long time.
Oh,
in fact, remakes go back to the silent era. Mary Pickford actually remade Tess of the Storm
yes.
Country, and she made it in 1914 and then remade it in 1922.
Right.
Let's talk more about that impulse to remake movies.
In general, I think the impulse to remake is, on the one hand, something was popular once, it made money once, it can be popular and make money again. There's that. There's also technologies change and attitudes change and a desire to see, well, will that story, will that environment work in a new age 20, 30, 40 years later? I think there is, to that extent, there's a creative impulse there to want to play with something a little bit. You have a good story, let's see how it works in a new environment. And then sooner or later, and I might as well make it sooner, we're going to talk about A Star is Born. And I think A Star is Born, which is a film that's been remade several times.
Yeah, it was in the 30s with Frederick March.
You have everything in the world you want. I hope it'll make you happy.
In the 50s, Judy Garland was in it.
What is it that makes him want to destroy himself?
In the 70s, Barbara Streisand and Kris Kristofferson were in it.
That's pretty. What is it?
Oh, just a little piece I wrote. Keep hoping it'll be a sonata when it grows up.
Make a hell of a song.
And our most recent one, which stars Lady Gaga.
Right.
And Bradley Cooper.
Right.
Can I tell you a secret? I think you might be a songwriter. But don't worry, I won't tell anybody. But I'm not very good at keeping secrets.
I think that is, it's a pretty good story. It's a kind of a story that holds up. And I believe different generations have an urge to see their own stars in good vehicles. And A Star is Born has been a vehicle that has served different generations of stars. And while young people listening to GLT today may go, Kris Kristofferson?
Yeah.
Barbara Streisand?
Oh, dear.
That was a huge deal that the two of them were, it's a terrible movie, by the way.
It is.
But it was a huge deal that the two of them were singing together, were putting a movie together. They came from different genres. There was a lot of press around that that got people into the theaters and made people excited.
So what really drives the need for remakes? Is that studio-driven or is it audience-driven?
To the extent that the two are not completely separable, I will go to the side of it's studio-driven. You know, unless somebody is taking their iPhone and doing A Star is Born with their sister and their little brother in the roles, these are big-budget movies. They only make them if they think that they're going to make a profit. So they do testing and they do guessing and they figure that put Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga on stage together and we're going to have a hit. What could make a hit? Well, there's A Star is Born. So it's not audience driven so much as it's the producers, the money people, recognizing that there's an appetite in the audience for particular stars at particular times, for particular stories, environments, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm saying environments. I keep saying environments because I think for Star Trek, for instance, and for sci-fi films, it's not just the characters and the or storylines we want to see again, we also want to visit that world that's been created.
How much does the rise of fan fiction have to do with the need for retelling a story in a new way or focusing on a particular character in a story, like in a spinoff of some sort? Does fan fiction figure into this in any way?
Fan fiction can continue far beyond on the end of a series or after a movie has played out in the movie theaters, and it certainly gives the money people a belief that there's still interest out there and still a sense out there. But also it does expand the world of the particular fiction that's been created. In, you know, Xena, for instance, which five of us still remember.
Xena Warrior Princess?
Xena Warrior Princess,
that's
yes.
Both of us and three other people.
Okay. Xena Warrior Princess had a massive fan fiction. There was an explosion of fan fiction around Xena Warrior Princess. And Missy Good, who was a very popular fanfic writer, got picked up to write a show, write an episode of Xena. But the thing to really that's remarkable about that is that the producers were paying attention to the fan fiction.
Well, when producers do decide, hey, I'm going to do a remake of, say, Tarzan or Ghostbusters or Ben-Hur or Conan, and then these movies go out and they bomb spectacularly and they lose a lot of money. I don't know how they could have gone wrong with Ghostbusters. I actually like the reboot of Ghostbusters as well, but it didn't do very well. Sherry, how do you make a good remake? Can you take us through, film 101 here, and how do you do that and be successful with it? Because they don't always get it right in Hollywood.
Well, first of all, just because something's a hit doesn't mean it's a good story. There are a lot of factors that make a film a hit at any particular time. So it's not always story, but if you're going to remake something, it better be a good story. It better have a plot and a narrative that is compelling, that is adaptable to a different time period and to different actors and to a different look and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you need to pick the right vehicle that has the right story, and then you need to pick the right actors. Though we are not under a studio system in the way we were 60 years ago, films were built around stars then. Films are still built around stars. So it's about the on-screen talent that you can bring to the picture and whether you've picked a good story. Was Ghostbusters a good story? No. It was a fun film, and it was a fun film in its day, and I think it was a fun film in our day too, quite frankly.
Yes.
But it was not that it was a great story, it was that it was just the right combination of fun, campy, great comedic actors,
and their interaction,
it was wonderful. It was a hit. Yeah.
All right, Sherry, they're remaking movies left and right in Hollywood.
Lack of imagination.
Yes, there we go. What cannot be remade? What cannot be revisited because of cultural changes? I've always thought that, well, it would probably be pretty hard to remake Blazing Saddles, for example.
Yeah, I think you're quite right about that. I think a lot of comedy can't be remade, especially when it's comedy that is, again, it's not a plot-driven movie, right? It's not a story that you can just take and transplant. It's physical humor, it's verbal humor, and those things are often very much temporally located. They don't translate very well, often don't translate well across eras and across generations. So a lot of comedies, I think, would be very difficult. I think other things that are really so of their time. I mean, a favorite movie, which every time I teach it, The Graduate. Great movie. One would think that would be kind of a serviceable plot for a remake. Young man, older woman, young man falls in love with older woman's daughter. But is that really what The Graduate is? No. That plot is not really what makes The Graduate The Graduate. What makes The Graduate a great film is it's a certain expression of the 60s. It's Mike Nichols' direction. It's about, through this sexual relationship, rejecting what is expected of our young hero. And yada, 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 yada. I don't think the 2000s care much about those kinds of things that make The Graduate The Graduate. So if you made a movie and called it The Graduate and put current actors in it and just kept those bare bones plot lines, I'm going to tell you it's not a remake. I'm going to tell you you used a few elements, but it's not really a remake because it's a quite different film. So one film that I thought could never be remade and I never wanted to see remade is Mary Poppins.
Oh.
It was so of the time. Julie Andrews owns that role. And really, Dick Van Dyke, you're going to have somebody else play a role that Dick Van Dyke played. You're crazy. And they did it. And I have been ranting and railing about this ever since I heard about it. Furious that they could desecrate such a classic. But you know, I saw the trailer to it and I started crying. I can't wait to see that movie. Can't wait.
That's Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University and GLT's culture maven. Of all the remakes coming out of Hollywood over the decades, there's one that's far and away remade more than any other. It's Romeo and Juliet. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Oscar nominations are out today. You can hear what remake Sherry Zeck would consider heresy in a bonus audio segment at WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. WGLT.org is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Colleen Reynolds, Ryan Denham, and Laura Kennedy. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.